the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Friday, September 18th, 2015. As the world continues to ignore the US-backed Saudi war against Yemen, we'll turn to journalist Joe Loria for an update. And 4 years after Occupy Wall Street began, activist and author Michael Gould-Wartofsky joins us for a retrospective. Plus, Betsy Leonda Wright discusses her book, Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. Today's program, which is coming up after the break, is a taped show as a result of KPFK staff cuts. I'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Yemen's exiled Prime Minister and Vice President Khalid Baha returned to his country on Wednesday, several months after a major war by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States has begun. He arrived at the port of Aden, which has been captured by Saudi and Emirati troops, and where several other ministers from the former government have arrived. Baha and many government officials have been taking refuge in Saudi Arabia after the Houthi rebel movement took over the nation. As of this recording, President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi remains in exile in Saudi Arabia. Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Persian Gulf, has been the target of a brutal and relentless war, of which U.S. military advisors and U.S.-supplied weapons are a major part. Aid groups have warned that the country is on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe, with about half the country's population at risk of starvation. Saudi forces have routinely prevented food and medical supplies from entering ports. They've killed nearly 5,000 people so far in the war. United Nations efforts to resolve the conflict have been repeatedly thwarted by Saudi Arabia. Joe Loria is an international affairs correspondent who has written for the Wall Street Journal, Middle East Eye, and Consortium News. And he now joins me from the lobby of the United Nations building in New York. Joe, let's begin with a question of why so many of these ministers, including the vice president and prime minister, have returned from exile in Saudi Arabia to the port of Aden in Yemen. Does it mean that Saudi Arabia is attempting to wrap up this war?
Yes, they'd like to take over Sana'a, the capital, being held by the Houthi, and restore President Hadi to power. Right now, they liberated Aden in July, and they are making that a makeshift southern capital. Prime Minister, as you said, has just arrived there, and we could assume that Hadi will try to return and direct operations from there. There is now troops from Qatar and Emirati and others fighting to try to take Sana'a. They haven't reached the city yet. The ambassador of Yemen to the United Nations, Hadi's ambassador, told me that he believes that city, the capital, will just fall without a shot being fired, that somehow the Houthi will run away from this fierce Gulf Arab coalition, which on the ground has had almost no experience fighting a war in decades. And here's the Houthi, who are hardened fighters, who have good equipment, and are actually killing, in some instances, huge numbers, well, 10, 20 soldiers at a time from Saudi Arabia and Emiratis. They've got good equipment, they're fighting, and especially they're going to fight in the northern province where they come from, where the Saudis will probably want to vanquish them, because I don't think this is a war where we're going to have a very easy political settlement, which brings me to the diplomatic side of this and the article that I published on consortiumnews.com last month, which is kind of short diplomatic history of this war. And every time the UN thought they had a promise that the Hadi side, the Saudi Hadi side, was going to come to UN-led peace talks, they backed out at the last minute and started demanding all these conditions when the UN was led to believe they didn't have conditions. And it just happened again last week. I mean, this UN has foolishly announced that we've got another peace talks beginning. The Houthi are going to be there, and the Hadi side and other parties. And it's a UN brokered deal that the parties will have to. And then, you know, we hear just yesterday, oh, no, we're not coming. Because you have to implement this condition of the Security Council resolution from a couple of months ago, which said the Houthi have to give up territory. And restore Hadi to power, which is what they're fighting for. So in other words, that's surrender. Hmm. They don't want talks. They want the Houthi to surrender. So there's no good faith on their side. From the history of this conflict diplomatically, and it's not that long. This only began in March. So we're talking about just a few months. This has been lots of people died already. And as you pointed out, many, many lives are at stake here. But the diplomatic history has been there's no good faith at all on the Saudi side. And the good faith on the Houthi side would have to be tested. But at least they agreed to show up these things.
Now,
and that is crisis, a real crisis. And it's going to end bloodily in Sana'a. I don't believe the Yemeni ambassador when he says that they're just going to run away and it won't be a shot fired. We're looking at probably a huge amount of casualties in the capital.
I want to go back to what you said earlier about the Houthis being hardened fighters. For Saudis and the Emiratis, these are two countries that don't fight that many wars, particularly sending in ground troops. And
right.
So these
right.
are pretty inexperienced soldiers. And so I understand that the reaction back home has been pretty severe from families who have
yes.
lost their loved ones. Is that a potential internal pressure that may make them rethink their strategy?
If those countries were democracies, absolutely,
right.
or anything like a democracy,
right.
even something like a, weakening American democracy, they don't have, the fact that they're speaking out and we know that at all is quite interesting. And, there are ways to put pressure, too, even if you don't demonstrate and write in a newspaper, especially if wealthy Saudi people's sons are getting killed somehow, although, I don't know who's dying, and there aren't huge numbers yet. But yes, I think that's potentially a problem. The problem is the Houthis fought several short wars against President Saleh over the last couple of years before Saleh was thrown out, and now they're allies, funny enough, against the Saudis. But so they have this fighting experience. They're not that old of a movement. Only began in the early 90s. They have not been that close to Iran until a few years ago when they were being attacked by Saleh, and the Syrians gave them some help. There's plenty of weapons around. And this is a movement that's going to fight for its existence. I mean, being pushed out of Aden is one thing. They never were in Aden. They don't really belong there. They're from the north. So they got kicked out of Aden. Even if they get kicked out of Sana'a, to go to the province north of there that borders on Saudi Arabia, the way the Saudis are prosecuting this war and not listening even to the Americans when they tell them to lighten up a little bit, I would be very surprised not to see some kind of real massacre taking place to try to destroy the Houthi once and for all. This is the way the Saudis have been prosecuting this war. They don't have any regard for human casualties here, and they're losing their own men and their GCC allies too, as you point out. So the Americans don't seem to be able to sit on them to tell them. As I've thought from the beginning of this conflict, the Americans were saying, because this all began during the Iranian nuclear talks, they kind of, I thought, said, well, let the Saudis be distracted and go after the Houthi and in Yemen while we, complete our deal so they're not focused on trying to sabotage the negotiation with Iran. Now, that's over now. And even now, I don't know what leverage the Americans have. They're giving them cluster bombs, as Human Rights Watch has reported. They are giving them weapons, logistics. So the U.S. is supporting them. But on the other hand, there have been some statements like, you're going too far and you're killing too many people. That was early on in the conflict. It was ignored. So we've seen this new independence by Saudi Arabia. And I fear bloodbath in Sana'a and then further north in the Houthi stronghold.
There's so many points there. Saudi Arabia has cited Iran as the main reason curb Iran's influence, but there's little evidence that Iran is actually fighting alongside the Houthis. They've been trying to send an aid. And then the U.S., with its tacit support, if they're not calling back Saudi Arabia, if they're not pulling back their major ally, who they supply with weapons and military advisors, they're playing both sides of a game by negotiating with Iran on the nuclear issue on the diplomatic level, and then fomenting a war or enabling a war that is supposed to be fighting Iranian influence. This makes the U.S. look terribly bad.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're fomenting it. And the State Department spokesman early on in this conflict said that Iran has no operational influence in Yemen. Okay? They have some influence. They provide some equipment, maybe. They're providing aid. But they don't have operational. So this is not an Iranian proxy war. And also, in a proxy war, it's usually both sides, the proxies, and that means there would be somebody fighting on Saudi Arabia's behalf if it was a Saudi-Iranian proxy war. In fact, Saudi Arabia is directly in the war, so they're not using proxies. They're fighting themselves.
Right.
And the Iranians, are they using the Houthi as proxies against Saudi Arabia to fight them? Yeah. Again, they don't have operational influence there, although they have influence. So this is an insane idea that the Saudis could somehow really damage Iran by going after this sect that's not even the same Shia sect as we have in Iran. And they're just going to crush it. And the reason is, I believe, from what I've learned from the diplomats who know most about Iran, about Yemen, rather, is that the Saudis have always controlled Yemen, and they want to make sure that whoever's in charge there, they can control, and they don't want anything resembling a democracy or a progressive government, which is what the U.N. was leading to on the bombs first fell. They broke that up. The Houthi had agreed to withdraw from Sana'a, and they were going to get 20% of the seats in parliament and ministry, and women were going to get 30%, and this kind of thing, and Saudi Arabia was going to lose control. There might actually be a popular assembly, and they were going to stop this, and they have done that all throughout the Middle East since the so-called Arab Spring has begun, in Egypt, in Bahrain, directly where they sent troops, in Egypt where they've supported a military coup, and now in Yemen. And in Syria, they've been, of course, backing extremists to try to get rid of Assad, and not only Saudi Arabia, but I'm saying they're one of the players. So, again, I think they want control of Yemen, and they don't seem to care about how many people are dying right now. And on their side, because there's no real democracy in these countries, they may be able to sustain a lot of casualties. Unlike in the 60s when Egypt fought against the Saudis, when Nasser was in power, the Egyptians lost something like 70,000 troops before they pulled out of Yemen. I don't know if that's kind of the casualties we'll find with Saudi and the GCC side, but at some point, I think you're right, and that might play a role, that they won't be able to sustain that many casualties.
Well, the reason why these casualties keep racking up partly is that there has been a silence on the international level, and the United Nations this week condemned what they call a virtual silence on civilian casualties in the Yemeni conflict. Interesting that, of course, Syrian massacres and refugees have finally begun taking center stage on the world media, but the fact that there are millions in Yemen on the brink of starvation and that hasn't received nearly enough attention is sort of shocking. I've been looking at photos of Yemeni children from the inside, and it's unbelievable, the ribs sticking out, eyes popping out. Literally, these babies are starving to death because Saudi Arabia is preventing aid from coming in. How far can you push a poor population?
This is all politicized, as you well know. In Syria, whoever has escaped, the West is trying to say it was all Assad, who they're running away from Assad. When a lot of the Kurds, of course, were running away from ISIS, like the well-known child who died on the beach, who happened to be white, and it got a lot of people upset. So he was escaping Islamic State, not Assad. But if you could say this is a reason to overthrow Assad more because of all the influx of refugees coming from Syria, you do that. The dead Yemeni children killed by a Saudi coalition and by Houthis are fighting back. There's no question about it. Both sides are killing civilians. But this is not going to get very much attention in the United States or interest. The Saudis, our friends, they're fighting for what? What, for democracy? No one would believe because they're not a democracy.
Right.
But they want to restore their guy who is Hadi. They want control of Yemen, and they're going to get it. I mean, by hook or crook, it kills many people as possible. This is my view of what's going on there.
Yeah.
And it's sad. It's really sad that the UN has been marginal. Where I'm standing right now in the lobby of the UN is marginalized completely in any role to try to bring about a political settlement here that would have to give some role to Houthi. I asked the Yemeni ambassador, when it's all over, will they participate in government? Yes, he said. We're willing to bring them in. I said, well, that's what they wanted to do to begin with, and why did you start this war? try the diplomacy. They didn't try the diplomacy, and they bombed, and we'll see what kind of role the Houthi will have in it, and I think they want to crush them. I don't see, and I could be wrong, this is just guesswork, from what I've seen on the front of this war, they will not stop before they've fatally wounded the Houthi movement, this 30-year-old movement.
Well, I want to thank you, Joe, so much, as always, for shedding light on an issue that is just not getting enough coverage. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much. I'm sure we'll
talk
to you again.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Joe Loria. He is the United Nations correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He also writes for Middle East Eye and Consortium News. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. September 17th this week marked the fourth anniversary of the start of the historic Occupy Wall Street movement, which was born in New York City and spread around the world like wildfire. We turn today to examine that movement with the benefit of hindsight. A book by Michael Gould Wartofsky paints an intimate portrait of the nearly two-month-long encampment in Zuccotti Park, renamed Liberty Square, New York City, providing an insider's view that is informed by deep familiarity with the actors involved. Gould Wartofsky documented the actions in detail. His book is called The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. Michael Gould Wartofsky also writes for The Nation, The Monthly Review, Salon, and Jacobin. Welcome to Uprising.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
Now, your book was based on a large number of interviews that you did with Occupy activists, but also from your own vantage point as a participant in the movement. And I want to begin there. How did your participation inform your writings and observations? You're not writing about it from the outside looking in. In fact, you use the words avowedly partisan to describe your views.
That's right. And my participation also extends back before Occupy and extends after what we call Occupy, and really kind of inform my perspective on how to go about writing this book. I think a lot of the coverage of the movement, both in media and in academia, was at first kind of dismissive and then very interested and then lost interest very quickly. But what I tried to do and what this perspective of partisan observation of embedded inquiry, what that gave me was, I think, a longer term view. So to be able to situate the Occupy moment in a longer arc of mobilization and also to follow the occupiers into exile after the pepper spray and the tear gas had cleared and to try to see what endured after. So I think that the perspective of being someone who was on the ground on September 17th and kind of stayed, at the ground level of the movement, didn't try to kind of look at it from the outside looking in or from the end point looking backward, really framed it for me in a way that allowed me to tell a different kind of social history than I think in much of my field and in much of social science.
Did you know from the moment that it started that this was going to be historic? And I ask that question because you describe how in the lead up to Occupy Wall Street, of course, it didn't come out of nowhere. There were other gatherings, and you showed up to several of these thinking they would be bigger than they were and left disappointed. And so when the September 17th, 2011 occupation, the encampment began, did you have a sense that this time it would be different?
I didn't. And I thought that the context was different. I was surprised that there hadn't been more resistance and more of a mobilization since the economic crisis hit. And of course, there had been to some extent, but I was curious to see where this one would lead. And at first, it didn't seem like much more than 2,000 people in a park. I didn't realize that it was going to last the night, let alone 2 months, and spread to 900 plus cities around the world, as it had spread from the world to New York City. So I think that's kind of what kept me in it was this was an anomaly. This was something that we hadn't seen on the left in this country for a long time in terms of the convergence of social forces that it made possible. And not just in the parks and the squares and the kind of, you know, in front of the cameras, but also in neighborhoods, in workplaces, in schools and universities. So that was something that that proved that this time was different to me.
And there was also a lot happening around the world in the lead up to Occupy Wall Street that we don't often link to what happened in Zuccotti Park. After the recession hit here in the United States, in Wisconsin, there was the uprising there. But then around the world, you saw the revolution in Egypt, the Indignados encampment in Spain. How did those broader movements and social upheavals in other parts of the U.S. and around the world lay the groundwork for Occupy Wall Street?
That's right. And Occupy wouldn't have been Occupy without that wave of mobilizations that was, you know, truly global in scale at that time. And it was a creature of that historical moment. It was a creature of that global evolution in tactics and strategy on the part of a global 99%. So, you know, it started out, of course, with the Arab revolutions and very quickly was taken up by protesters in Wisconsin who tied it to their revolt against the austerity regime there. And then, of course, the all across the Mediterranean that spring, occupations were popping up in places that they weren't expected, like Spain, places that they were, like Greece. And all of those occupations, protests and strikes and the revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa in particular, had a demonstration effect on the occupiers that I interviewed in New York City, also in Oakland, Chicago, Atlanta, and other places. And many of them had watched and listened to and learned from the example and took as a source of inspiration and also a source of solidarity for themselves. You know, it went both ways once Occupy Wall Street emerged. So this was truly a creature of a global movements and a moment for those movements all around the world.
Among the most memorable and important messages and slogans that came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement was this idea that we are the 99%. Where did that come from? How crucial was that message, you think, to the success of the occupation?
I do think that the message that it conveyed was crucial. It could have been, you know, put in different ways, phrased in different ways. But I think that particular framing of the problem and the fundamental dynamic, the conflict between, you know, the wealthiest 1% and the rest of us, basically, was a very effective one. It also, of course, erased some things and obscured some things and you know, raised a lot of questions as well. But it came from poor people's movements. It's been attributed to anarchist academics and to Adbusters, to David Graeber, to various sources. But I found its first usage was actually before all that, before Occupy was even a thing, in March of 2012. And it came out of this occupation of the Capitol building in New York State by a number of poor people's organizations, housing, labor organizations, who were facing the long arm of austerity that was then reaching, you know, all across our state and all across the country. And then it was very quickly taken up by and turned into something that, you know, is not just a statistic, but a strategy and a strategy of, you know, basically of class struggle in a way that that did not call itself that, but allowed people to see that they shared some of their problems that they were facing with other people who were like them, other people who were not like them, and that they could find some common ground, some common cause in that.
Now, you interviewed a large number of people, about half of whom were those who participated in Occupy Wall Street in New York, and the rest were from four other major cities where the Occupy movement spread to, but also around the world and cities around the world. Tell us about the interviews you did. I mean, that's a lot of data to draw from.
Certainly, and I would have loved to have done more, but I thought that it was important that I put this book out when I did. But the 80 interviews I did, they started out just kind of based in New York City. But I realized I was going to offer a very incomplete picture. Of course, you know, in New York City, we like to think that the world is in New York City. But, you know, it required that I speak to people in these seven other cities. So I spoke to people in Oakland and Chicago and Atlanta and Philadelphia here in the United States. And then I spoke as well to people in Athens, London, and Madrid. And of course, I couldn't give a truly global picture. And I tried to be a little bit radically humble as I did this research and be clear about the limitations of what I knew, but also to you know, be able to get some perspective from people on the ground and you know, all these sites of struggle around the world.
You also archived, I understand, the communications of Occupy Wall Street, their posters and flyers, and their internal communications. So why was that important, and what did that tell you about the movement?
Right. So I think that, you know, there are certain things that you can glean from just the visual dimension of these movements by what they produce, by what the kind of materials that they actually produce and that they use to communicate. And then, of course, what they're communicating. And of course, the internal debates were very intense and very sharp. The only way you could really, you know, access those various perspectives and also to try to see what, you know, how people were being mobilized and how the frame and the message was evolving. Was to trace those communications and to cross-check, you know, the observations that I had made, that other people had made in my interviews with other evidence that I could find, you know, just to give a bigger and a fuller and a clearer picture, because I felt that the movement deserved that.
Now, let's also talk about the fact that when the occupation in New York City in Zuccotti Park began, which was the kind of the seed that spread elsewhere, when that began, it transformed pretty quickly. When it first started, you mentioned there were about 2,000 people, mostly young and white. What did it transform into? Very soon, there was the People of Color Working Group that formed. There were other sort of aspects. And a mini society formed that had many hallmarks of what societies need, you know, to be fed both in mind and through food.
That's right. You know, those counter institutions in the park and other places that that fed people, that clothed people, that sheltered people, that also opened up spaces for them to you know, really exercise some degree of control over their own lives for once. I think that that, you know, was part of the mass appeal. Another was that there were these really, really strong connections that were made between the occupiers and people who'd been doing this work for a long time in New York City and other places like Oakland that were formed at that time. Another piece of the puzzle that's often left out is the role of the movement, we could say a proto-movement for Black Lives. At that time, the Troy Davis case brought a lot of people out into the streets. That was the first week of Occupy. That was a moment when people converged from the movement for racial justice and the movement for economic equality. Another moment came when people were coming under attack in Zuccotti Park and elsewhere in New York City. And this was broadcast all across the city and across the country. And people came out to defend it and effectively defended it for some time against the forces of the police and of the municipal administration. So this was again a moment of convergence, and you know, that was kind of part of the power of the thing, and it also was part of what gave it its social base, which was much bigger, I think, than anyone could have anticipated on that day one, when most of us were you know, some young white kids in a park.
Now, during the nearly two-month-long occupation, communication between a very, very large group of people and with each other would have been much more cumbersome were it not for the very interesting and unique method of communication developed right from the start, marked by the consensus-style communication where people used hand signals to gesture to one another and echoed each other's words to amplify them, the so-called people's microphone. I mean, you know, in retrospect, it might sound a little bit cheesy, but at the time, how seriously did people take these ways of communicating with one another?
Yes, they took it very, very seriously. And I think, you know, to those who are watching, listening, who were part of this in your city, this is something that was not just, you know, adopted enthusiastically in New York City. It was something that worked for people everywhere, you know, across the country. The people's microphone allowed people to speak and to be heard in a way that people normally aren't spoken and heard in our society, especially you know, those who are most historically oppressed and marginalized, and those voices were echoed across the squares, and that was something that was really powerful. It also it worked as a way of bonding people closer together, as a source of solidarity. It was a source of reflection. You could reflect on the words you were hearing. You were speaking them at the same time. You could also, you know, decide together with 1,000 other people what, you know, what you were going to do about it, in a way that made sure that those voices were heard. So, you know, it was a very effective mode of social movement innovation that I think we're still seeing and hearing today.
Let's also talk about how the fact that the Occupy Wall Street encampment went on for nearly 2 months. And during that time, one very important occurrence that took place in the United States was the execution of African-American death row inmate Troy Davis. What impact did that have on the encampment?
So that was really the moment. I would argue that was the moment when it became a movement, a space for movement building, and not just for occupying, for organizing, and not just for occupying. This was a moment when thousands of people, you know, came out, and millions of people across the country participated in some way in the protest campaign to try to save Mr. Davis's life. And we failed, as we know. And this was also something that showed a lot of people that the system, the whole system, was guilty, as they said. And you know, it was an indictment of the American criminal justice system. At the same time, as a lot of for the first time, as a lot of young white people were feeling just a whiff of you know, what communities of color have been facing in this country for a very long time. And so there was a convergence in the streets that night after we marched for Troy Davis. And it was the first time that Zuccotti Park really started to look more like New York City. And this was also a very important moment for people watching across the country who saw this, that, you know, the bankers who had, you know, destroyed millions of people's lives were walking free. An innocent man had just been put to death by the state.
Eventually, of course, the New York occupation was dismantled, as happened in other cities as well. But it couldn't have lasted forever, right? It shouldn't have come as a surprise that eventually city authorities would try to end it. And I'm wondering if there were discussions that took place during, at least in New York, during the occupation, where you were a participant, where people could see the long view that may be manifest, you know, of what would happen to something that started out as a physical encampment, but eventually would have to transform into something else.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I argue in the book, the occupation was bound to have a limited half-life. Occupations everywhere that you can't occupy forever, as you're saying. And, you know, there were all kinds of, there's a very high threshold for participation in a 24-hour occupation. So if you're asking, you know, people with families, people who are struggling to make ends meet, to make that the only tactic available, I think you're also, you know, you're also potentially leaving some people out who could be part of of the movement. And you know, the occupation wasn't always going to be there. Some people realized that and tried to do something about it and tried to, you know, parlay this into mass organizing, tried to parlay it into occupy our homes, tried to parlay it into efforts to engage more deeply with the political economy, with the structures at, you know, in question. And I think that, you know, there were some things that did endure, that did outlive the occupied squares. But I think it came too little too late in terms of thinking through how this could, you know, this could be channeled, moved, this anger could be moved into something that, you know, would really was built to last.
Finally, Michael, let's talk about Occupy Wall Street's legacy. During Superstorm Sandy in New York, a lot of New York occupiers found a reason to organize. But again, that was sort of transient. And we've covered the strike debt and the debt collective who are organizing, you know, people refusing to pay back student loans, who are calling for free higher education. How would you quantify or characterize the legacy of Occupy Wall Street?
Right. So you see it... I think, you know, everywhere where young people, where workers and students and poor people are working together in a way that they weren't before Occupy Wall Street. Everywhere they're working to leverage whatever power they have against the power of the 1%. From, you know, the fight for 15, which actually, you know, there was an effort to organize a fast food workers union by Occupy Oakland even before. You know, the institutional unions ever got involved. There was, as you mentioned, there was, you know, an effort to have a debt strike, Occupy Sandy, the climate justice movement, the fight for net neutrality, which scored a historic victory recently, and a lot of the momentum around the people of color working groups, you know, really was part of the wave of and the upsurge that we saw. In 2012, in 2013, around the Trayvon Martin case, the Million Hoodie March, and eventually the movement for Black Lives. So there was a lot of energy and a lot of action potential in this coalition, and that remained after you know, after the authorities did what they did.
My guest has been Michael Gould-Wartofsky. He is the author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. You can learn more about his work at michaelgouldwartofsky.com or check our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, for the link. We'll be right back after this break. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Republicans often accuse President Obama of waging a class war. Progressives often wish that were so. While many of us acknowledge class as a crucial factor in political analysis, we don't place nearly enough emphasis on it in our political organizing. Now, a new book by one of the nation's leading progressive activists studying class tackles this issue head on. Betsy Leonda Wright is the program director at the Boston-based group Class Action. She's written a new book called Missing Class: Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. In an extensive and academically rigorous study spanning years, Leonda Wright attended dozens of political group meetings, recorded them, interviewed hundreds of attendees in order to determine their class backgrounds, and then reviewed the recordings to see if patterns emerged. Her findings on the extent to which people's behavior depended on their class were surprising. When Leander Wright first began gathering the data, she expected gender and race to be greater drivers of people's behavior patterns. Instead, she found that by far the most commonalities were among people of a similar class, even if they were different by race, gender, age, generation, and issue. Betsy Leander Wright has written earlier books called Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists, and The Color of Wealth, the story behind the U.S. racial wealth divide. She now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Betsy Leander Wright.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So your book is fascinating in that it touches upon a subject that we talk about all the time in the media, but we don't really talk about, right? First, how do you define class in general? I mean, is it just income?
No. In fact, income is a real unreliable way to categorize people because it can go up and down every year and be less at the two ends of your life. So primarily, I looked at your parents' education level and type of occupation or where their income came from and your type, where you grew up, housing and neighborhood. And then that's your class background. And then as an adult, how much formal education do you have? Where's your income come from? Where do you live? There's a lot of other class indicators, but I think that those three tend to line up roughly similar, education, occupation, and housing and neighborhood. And if you know those three things about somebody, you know quite a bit about their class life story.
And so it's about culture, right? It's about how we interact with people, how we carry ourselves, what we like and dislike, the way in which we approach things like humor and honesty.
Exactly.
So how are those qualities, how do those qualities then intersect with the other two categories that we always do bring up, which is gender and race?
Right. Yeah, and thanks to the movements of the last 50 years, there's been a lot of conversation about race and gender identities and all the profound ways that those can influence the dynamics within a group, as well as, of course, the inequities in the wider society. And class, we really haven't had that conversation yet. When people talk, when leftists talk about class, it's usually about, you know, the unfair rules of the economy, the ways things are rigged so that the haves get more and the have-nots get less. In terms of class cultures, class, the, you know, identities, the process of naming your own identity, having some common language to talk about that, and the ways that that doesn't nearly get talked about as much. But in fact, our class background influences us profoundly. That, of course, you move on from there, you learn and grow as an adult, but we always have that starting place of the class that we grew up in. And I think it's far more, there's far more firm patterns than most people suspect. And I was surprised when I did the research for the book. I looked at over 300 activists in 25 groups, and I thought, oh, well, sometimes it'll primarily, like, you know, who tends to do what during conflicts? It'll be mostly gender, right? Or, there'll be these things that'll be so different between white and black activists. By far, the most commonalities were people of similar class, even if they were different by race, gender, age, you know, generation, issue that they were working on. So much was in common, and that's just unseen, that's why I use the word see in my subtitle. I think we can strengthen social movement organizations by seeing class cultures.
So you found that within these interactions among individuals and groups, that class tended to be a greater binder than race or gender even.
Well, of course, there are sometimes tensions and clashes, and, you know, there were episodes of racism, and so I'm not saying that those are easy bridges to build. They can be hard, but just in terms of, like, for example, how people talk and how activists talk about political issues, that the upper middle class people, like second or third generation to go to college and elite schools, they just, whatever their race, they talked in those typically college-educated ways of using a lot more abstract terms, generalizations playing a much bigger role than stories or concrete examples. They're
more likely to use the word dialectic.
Yeah. Well, that, of course, didn't surprise me at all. Right, exactly, or hegemony. But that didn't surprise me, of course, the sort of academic terms. But just the use of general terms, even in ordinary vocabulary, words like context and perspective, and even the word issue. Whereas working class and poor activists, people who have not gone to college, neither have their parents, used much, no matter what their race. Of course, they sounded different. They spoke different dialects. In some cases, their first language was different languages. So the aphorisms and sayings that they drew from their background were different ones. But the fact that they had this more colorful way of speaking, that there were more concrete names, places, events, action verbs in their talk about making social change, and that they, when they had to explain something, they would turn to a metaphor or an analogy. That turned out to be true of working class and poor activists across race, gender, age, everything else.
So we tend to conflate race and class a lot, right?
Yeah.
The term poor people of color, low income and poor, those generally go hand in hand. Is that in your research and in all of these groups and people that you looked at, did you find that there was perhaps less overlap than we give credit for?
Yeah, I somewhat already knew that from my work with my organization's Class Action on the web at classism.org. And for years, we do class and classism workshops, and we talk about the intersection of race and class. But who is like overjoyed hugging the facilitators at the end of the workshop? There's two big themes. And one is the people of color, especially like African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, the groups that people expect. If they're overgeneralizing mm-hmm. from the class race correlations that do exist, they're like, everyone thinks I'm poor, and actually I grew up as an inheritor. I grew up summering on Martha's Vineyard. My parents went to Ivy League colleges. Like, thank goodness you acknowledged that. You know, class is not equated. They say things like, people keep trying to get me to explain the inner city to them. I've never been there, you know. So they're atypical because, of course, there is a correlation between those historically discriminated against ethnic groups and working class and poor status. But it's just a correlation. It's not universal. And the other group that is like I've gotten so many hugs from at the end of workshops like is working class and poor white people. Because people are always like, yeah, my middle class colleagues, they assume that I'm like them. They make all these assumptions. They talk nasty about white working class people, not knowing I am one. Nobody knows I'm first generation to go to college, or nobody knows I'm in poverty. They assume if you're white, you must be middle class, which is disproportionately true. But actually, the majority of poor people in this country are white.
Yeah,
so
absolutely. So let's talk about how you have applied the theories of a French guy named Pierre to your Pierre Bourdieu to your analysis and to what you've observed in this, I guess, not just quintessential American struggle, but probably something that people from time immemorial have struggled with. For as long as there have been these understandings of race, class, and gender, and differences between people, we've struggled with how to communicate in group meetings and group settings. So how do you see the patterns and explain them to a layperson who's never heard of Pierre Bourdieu?
That's right. Yeah, I'm not a big theory wonk either, but when I fell in love with him when I read his work, he's talking about the French intelligentsia. When he started to say the word misrecognition of class and the kinds of class that indicators that are not money, but you carry with you your education, your credentials, your manners, your accent, and your tastes especially. And what he was saying was all these people are claiming to be so public-spirited the scientists, the artists, that they're just doing it for the pure love of what they're creating and the pursuit of truth. And he said they were misrecognizing their class advantages and that they were, in fact, competing with each other for symbolic rewards and pretending that they were not also super class advantage, but not even pretending because they're not even recognizing it. And I was like, wow, that's exactly like the activists in the U.S. who, because those of us who don't have a lot of money, but we have a lot of education and our everything about us sort of fits into the dominant class, even if everything about us is counterculture, that counterculture grew out of white upper middle class culture in so many cases that you can go around, for example, being greener than thou or more egalitarian than thou, you know, feeling superior because of your the kind of food that you eat or the kind of group process that you use. And you're not recognizing that those are exclusionary practices, that there's other people who don't share your tastes or don't share the knowledge of you know, like the hand signals used in the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. They can't, a lot of working class and poor people and others couldn't participate because they didn't know the hand signals, or had more trouble participating, or, you know, have not encountered certain vegan products before. So the misrecognition of how class is playing out in the more alternative and radical parts of the left, I was like, I'm following in this guy's footsteps, and I'm going to learn every one of his concepts, even though they're hard. And I'm going to say, this is all elite cultural capital. The like, oh, you know, my food is more local than your food, and my group process is more participatory and egalitarian than your group process. That is, you know, elite cultural capital being deployed to put you more in the center of a social, of an effort for social change, than somebody else who hasn't encountered those things.
And so these are the sort of tools. I mean, what you're referring to are often the very basics on which activists in the U.S. Right. build their credentials for being activists. And of course, this does transcend race and gender, and people are not very aware of it. So, what are some of the ways in which that can be seen, and I don't know if corrected is the right term, but at least acknowledged and in some ways undermined.
Yeah, I think I'm hoping that my book promotes awareness of how various classes do things, various movement traditions, like how what might be done differently if you haven't been in community organizing or the labor movement, how problems are approached there. And I'm hoping to that just be, that awareness will increase the respect that college-educated activists have, especially those who also come from a privileged background, that you'll just start to have more respect that there are some good solutions and good things you can that might work for your group, too.
And not to make assumptions about the class of the people right. that you're interacting with.
Right. Well, that's the other thing, is that I found that most people guessed wrong about the class of other people in the group. They were using race, as we were saying, as an equivalent of class in ways that weren't true. Or, you know, they just there's class secrets in every group. And, you know, I got to put on these 3D glasses by doing this research, I could see these class patterns pop out by knowing the class background of the people at the meetings.
So you made sure and found that out before you saw them interact, and that gave you a better idea of how to see the patterns?
Actually, I would observe the meetings without knowing.
Oh, so you got really good at identifying people's class.
And then I had people fill out a survey that had like their parents' education and stuff. Got and so it. Then I analyzed the surveys and clumped people and categorized them. And then I listened to the audio again if the meeting was taped and read the transcripts and the notes and everything and did the follow-up interviews with the knowledge, and a lot of the dynamics in the meetings look completely different to me before and after, that there'd be some way that, you know, be a majority college-educated professional group, but there'd be like, it turned out there'd be like four, you know, working class or poor people in the meeting. And, you know, they all had the same take on a certain issue. And I didn't even see that until later when I had everybody pegged by class. I'd be like, whoa. And they're like approaching this problem in the same way as each other. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. But people don't have to do a big social science research project to have that experience I had of seeing the class patterns pop out. All you have to do is the kind of stuff that Class Action encourages groups to do, which is to make a safe space to share your class life story with each other.
Finally, Betsy, how do you think our conversations around class can change by not just acknowledging class differences and self-identifying class within activist groups, but also changing our national approach to class? Because a broader context of all this was what I brought up in the beginning of this interview, that class is a very touchy subject in the U.S., and people accuse each other of waging class warfare, and of course others say, I wish. and certainly that has to change at a time when income inequality is higher than before, you know, than since the Gilded Age, and at a time when even lawmakers are slowly accepting that things like the minimum wage at least have to increase. Do you hope or foresee that we are transforming our approach to class and that that may feed into how we interact with one another?
I am a little bit hopeful that so many people went through temporary hardships during the Great Recession. I do hear some signs that people who previously were like, no, everyone can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and we're a classless society and all those myths have, there may be a little more empathy that with long-term poor people that there can actually be no jobs and no affordable place to live. That can happen to a person despite their best efforts. So I am hopeful. I'm a big believer in social movements. I think that's how almost all the progress we've ever had in this country have been through mass movements. And so we need a mass movement for economic justice in this country.
My guest has been Betsy Leonda Wright. She is a program director at the Boston-based group Class Action, and her book is called Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. Her earlier books included Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists, and The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the U.S. Racial Wealth Divide. This is Uprising. And by the way, if you'd like to listen to my new podcast that I've been recording for several weeks now, you can find it on iTunes. It's called Uprising Uncut. Or you can also go to my website, sonalikohatkar.com, and find a link. Again, that's my new podcast. It's an off-the-cuff analysis and a little bit of humor thrown in. And it literally is uncut. Again, you can find that on iTunes. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you on Monday.